Welcome to the Harper Voice, episode 118. This is a show all about Pokemon's Video Game Championship Series. I'm your host, Steven Morioka, and I am here with Alex Underhill.
Hey there.
Hey there, Alex. It's the new year, 2021. Happy New Year to you. And
yeah, happy new year. It's going to be totally different this time, hopefully.
Sure. I guess we're celebrating a year's worth of VGC officially on the Switch since events started last year around this time. But this year we are starting online, still in the COVID-19 pandemic. It's 2021. The number changed. We think it's going to be a little different from 2020. Maybe not. 2020 started the decade, right?
Is that how it works? I believe so. Yeah.
Okay, well, this decade sucks. Like, it's off to an awful start.
Yeah, no, this is going to be one to remember. Just imagine, like, when we're so much older, Steven, we're already pretty darn old, and we're just talking about this era. Like, it's like, oh, the 20s. The 20s.
Right. The 2020s. So bad. Yeah, it just makes me, from a competitive Pokemon perspective, like, it really makes me look back to the 2010s, and just, like, we had 10 full years of competitive VGC going for that decade. That was a nice
time. That was its whole life cycle for the most part. Like, obviously, you've talked on the podcast about the stuff that happened in 2005 and all the years up to 2010. But, like, that was when, like, VGC became VGC. I guess 2009 was the first year officially.
Right.
Of VGC. But really, like, you know, starting in 2010, that's when Ray Rizzo won Worlds First, and then, like, that's basically what started off this decade of Pokemon. Crazy to think that was so long ago.
And those are all live events. And while we in North America and Europe and Latin America and Oceania are very much likely starting all in online events this year, and we are, because Players Cup 3 qualifier is next weekend. But we're actually going to take a little detour to talk about a live event. And yes, you heard that right, a live event. So I wanted to bring this up because this occurred over the winter break when we were off. And this was held on December 29th, 2020. Actually, no, December 27th, 2020. Somewhere in between that range. December 27th, it looks like. But anyway, this was a live regional-sized event and a regional event in Taiwan. So Taipei, Taiwan. And this essentially was a regional for the Asia-Pacific region in that area. So everyone remembers how most of Asia-Pacific was redesignated away from Oceania back over the last summer. How Oceania only became New Zealand and Australia for TPCI. This is now TPC running things here. And they have this regional as part of their league building up into nationals here. So, Alex, just want to run some logistics here with you. Their attendance was 199 players. They had 7 Swiss rounds. They play a Swiss tournament. How nice. And had a top 16 cut. So this is just cool to see. Taiwan is in a very different place in the world with the pandemic, I suppose. And I'm just very curious, like, how things were run there. Like, did they wear masks? Was there social distancing? What kind of stuff did they have to go through to play in this tournament? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, if anybody has more information, we'd love to hear it. We did a little bit of, like, researching into it, but it was kind of coming up to dead ends. Like, just, if anybody knows more about this, we'd love to hear, because it's really cool to hear that live events are back and hopefully are being run safely. I do know from the little bit of information I've heard, like, you know, they had, like, paper pairings and stuff, and for the most part, it was run like a normal regional, like what we used to have for live events. It's really cool to see this this circuit finally kick off. I believe this is the first event of it, you know, from when they were kind of removed from the Oceania section of the circuit, and they can start playing some official Pokemon. This is great for them. Now, worth noting that the top four finishers were rewarded buys for nationals, which is interesting. It's like a concept from the past that I've never got to experience. But you, Steven, you've gotten to experience this back in what years?
In 2012 and 13, yes.
Gotcha. Okay. So those years in Black and White 2, I believe.
Yeah, both the first games and 2.
Yes. Okay.
But yeah, how these buys were working for this tournament here, it seems like the third and fourth place finishers get a first round buy at their upcoming national, I'm certain in the future, sometime this year. And the finalists are getting two rounds worth of buys. So both round one and two are going to be counted as wins for them, and they get to go 2-0 at the start.
Yeah, that's insane. Like insanely broken for a tournament run, just not having to worry about those first couple of rounds. There's a lot of uncertainty in the first couple of rounds of a tournament. Yeah, you can get your easiest matchups because, of course, everybody's on an even record. But also, you have just as much of a percentage, or maybe not just as much, but like, you know, you can also play a very strong and qualified player in the first round instead of playing them in the much higher rounds where you expect both of you to be undefeated or something. You are both currently undefeated and 0-0, and one of you has to lose. So it's nice to have that security knowing that you make it to the first two round, make it through the first two rounds. And then from that point on, you have a bit of a better idea of what to expect from the opponents you're going to be playing.
Yes, this is very nice for them. These buys are also just very, very broken at nationals tournaments. So I know it doesn't seem like they're going to have championship points or anything of that matter, but they really need to find some different kind of prizing because these buys are totally broken. Like for anyone who played in 2012 and 13 and at those nationals, you know how those buys were broken. And I was a recipient of one of those. Like, I did have a round one buy in 2013, which was the limit that year. 2012, you had the potential to get two buys at nationals for round one and two for being a finalist at any of the regionals previously during that circuit year. So, mm-hmm. Very broken.
Yes.
I just want to shout out the champion here, Tsai Hao Yu, who won this tournament in Taiwan. So, congrats to you. And, you know, we could break these team details down, but this was a while ago, and we actually have a different topic we want to talk about, too. So, Alex, do you have any final thoughts on the Taiwan regional here?
Yeah, I think it's worth mentioning the winning team while we're here, and maybe just the runner-up. We could just, like, do a little bit of talking about this top four, since we're mentioning the tournament, and we probably won't come back to it. So, really quick, the winner's team was Kartana Landorus, Tapu Fini, Ndidi Female, Dusclops, and Glacedrier. We saw the runner-up team had Rillaboom, Tyranitar, Rotomwash, Zapdos, Galarian Form, Clefairy, and Spectrier.
Like, whoa.
Yeah,
what
so
a team.
Both of these teams are actually pretty cool. I haven't seen anything exactly like these before. You know, the winning team had a double terrain, which is not terribly common, though. I've seen it here and there. And just a very strong physically offensive offense between Kartana and Glacier and Landorus. Just seems mostly like, to use a overused term, good stuffs. You know, like there's just a lot of good Pokemon put on here. And, you know, I guess it has a Trick Room mode with Glacier, but it's also got an out of Trick Room mode with Landorus and Kartana. And Finny is kind of in between. So really, it's just a flexible team that relies on using good Pokemon.
Yeah, I like that balanced nature of the team there, and like despite having the two terrains, they don't really interfere too much with one another. Like Tapu Fini doesn't really care if psychic terrain goes up too much. Ndidi would care more, I guess, if the terrains change, but otherwise, like the roles are different, and it's a very balanced team that lets you play, you know, in and out of Trick Room, which is nice.
So the runner-ups team seems to rely a bit more on physically offensive offense. I probably should have picked a different way to phrase that. But yeah, they're physical attackers. Spectrier is a special attacker, of course, but it's going to be dropping the defense of the opponent, which helps support the three physical attackers on the team, Rillaboom, Tyranitar, and Zapdos, which are all known for doing high amounts of damage. Zapdos, of course, is going to steer away, intimidate, and stat drops from being spammed into the team, so they can just continue to do as much damage as they want. I don't notice any other notable weakness policy procs. Maybe Tyranitar is holding the weakness policy. We don't actually have full information on these teams, but and the Clefairy here is here probably to just enable maybe a bit of setup, whether it's a nasty plot on the Rotom, a nasty plot on the horse, or something else.
Yeah. So honestly kind of a bizarre sounding team, but now in the theory, it looks like it worked, and obviously it did. Got second place at this almost 200 person regional here. So good stuff. That was again second place, Li Yuheng. And I'm going to move on here to our semifinalists. Pai Yu Ping used a team of Venusaur. This was third place. Venusaur, Torkoal, Tapu Fini, Raichu, Kanto, and Moltres, Galarian, and Regirock. So, you know, a lot of different modes here. We got Regirock here. We got Sun mode for this team. And otherwise, like Raichu to help support the Moltres and the Tapu Fini's weakness in electric. Also, obviously, can. Actually, I don't know which Pokemon would have the weakness policy here.
We actually have team information for this one.
Cool.
I clicked the link next to it. So, yeah, the Moltres is holding that weakness policy. So, of course, Raichu can Volt Switch, activate it. Wow, the Raichu has Draining Kiss. So, I guess if it wanted to side activate the weakness policy but not switch out, I actually don't know what other reason it's on the team.
It does, like, slightly less damage.
That too, yeah, and heals the Raichu, I guess, if its sash had been broken by, like, sand damage or something. I don't know. very, very funny. The Moltres also has, like, Sucker Punch. I did want to make a note that there was a Venusaur on a Tapu Fini team. You don't see that too often, but the Venusaur has foregone Sleep Powder entirely, and it has three attacks and Protect.
I like that so, a lot. I like that a lot.
That lines up with the team well, I think. The Tapu Fini has Soak. And yeah, there's just a lot of cool stuff on this team. I definitely recommend checking it out on victoryroadvgc.com and then navigate to the page where they have the results for this 2020 Taiwan regional. But this team is a pretty cool one when you actually break down the full information. And then looking at the next team, we have another Venusaur next to Incineroar, Rotom Wash, Togekiss, Porygon2, and Stack Attacka. So we have another fun rock type on this team. Regirock on the last one. Of course, I am a big, big Regirock fan. Stack Attacka on this one. Also a really cool Pokemon. Venusaur just kind of hanging out here. You know, completing a Fire, Water, Grass core, but no Torkoal, no Sun Setter here. So maybe it's just there to counter other Sun, or honestly just to be a good Pokemon. Venusaur is pretty strong, and it's got that G-Max form that can obviously take advantage of the ever-broken residual-damaging G-Max moves. So, that's kind of fun to see, but otherwise I don't have too much else to say about the team.
I do like it as a check, sort of, to have an answer to some other Sun teams with your own Venusaur. Venusaur can operate, obviously, without needing that extra, that double boost in speed. It's really bizarre, though, to kind of see Venusaur without its best friend Torkoal, so I guess that works here. Also, just like Fire, Water, Grass core, that's also a very nice balance for you too.
Yep. And Togekiss is the last thing I'll make a comment on, I guess. Just you don't see Togekiss much anymore. It was so dominant through like the first half of 2020, and then the Crown Tundra really put it down. So Togekiss getting another big finish. Maybe it's not totally irrelevant anymore.
Nah, and that is the top four of the Taiwan regional, and we should probably start mentioning this for any time we reference teams and where these results are coming from, but you did already. This is coming from Victory Road VGC, and we have a bad habit, I think, in the past of just like spouting out teams, results, and all these things, and not giving a reference for other people to check these where they came from. So there we go for this one. So we'll try and make sure we have a good habit of that for this year.
Yep, and there's a lot of other tournaments that took place over the winter break. Steven and I probably won't cover them in full unless there's, a need, a lack of content, or if you guys really let us know, just like send us an email or something that you want to hear about a lot of these tournaments, because there's been a ton. There's also a bunch of the grassroots tournaments coming up. You know, there's been a pretty good grassroots scene. We're just not going to be able to cover them all. So if there are like certain tournaments that you'd love for us to discuss, do let us know. And then also while we're kind of just, reminding, people of things, why don't we remind people to sign up for the IC, Steven? You know, that is coming up. Make sure that you sign up if you're planning to play on it. Maybe even sign up if you're not planning to play in it, just to give yourself that option. It doesn't hurt to, take, a minute or two to boot up your Switch, go into game and just enter the tournament so that you have the option when the tournament comes around. And is it next week or is it 2 weeks from now?
Yeah, that is next week.
Yeah, so what you know, just like make sure you just get signed up before the tournament actually starts, because you can't sign up once it starts. I think the deadline is going to be like you know, that Thursday for us in the, like, you know, U.S. Central Time Zone. But yeah, it's like at UTC midnight for Friday or whatever. You know, the beginning of the day, I think, right?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So you want to make sure that you do it before then, before next Friday, UTC zero. So make sure to sign up and just get that done, so that way you're not sad when the tournament starts and you forgot to.
Yeah, that is a solid PSA, and everyone just remember to check your all those accounts. You know, they're your training club account, link to the what account are you supposed to link it to make sure you're can qualify for this?
It's a special science, Steven. Like, there's some okay. weird stuff that I've had issues with. I know plenty of players have had issues with. I just know that mine works now, and so I try not to think about it because I don't want to tamper with it and mess anything up. But yeah, there are some accounts that you have to make sure are properly linked. Do a bit of research on that if you're worried about it, just to make sure. For the most part, you should be fine, but if you have, like, multiple Switch Online accounts or multiple players, like play Pokemon accounts or something, like it can get a bit weird if the accounts aren't properly linked, essentially. And that has caused some players to not be able to play in the next stage of the tournament, even though they were able to qualify. So don't be like those players. Make sure that everything is set up correctly.
Yep. So we do have that Battle Online competition for Players Cup 3 next weekend. Again, everyone remember to sign up for it. You can play in it. Of course, you want to play in it if you want to qualify. And, you know, good luck with all that. So, while that is a one-game tournament where you can play 15 games in a day for those 3 days, and then that's it, and you got to wait about a month or longer till you find out how you did and whether you're in or not, we're going to not talk about that, but talk more actually about the further stages of the tournament and double elimination for these Players' Cup tournaments we've had. So we've had two so far in the past. We have some information to reference, and we're going to have this third one, obviously, which has been officially announced already, and probably more the way things are going. So, Alex, we're going to talk about double elimination, Swiss, these tournament structures, what we like, what we don't like, what do we think would work for these Players' Cup tournaments. Go ahead and kick us off here.
Yeah, and then just a preview for later, we'll also break down a bit of the open team sheets aspect of the tournament, too. So, yeah, double elim is something that I'm finally going to get to eloquently, or if that's the right word, rant about here on the podcast. And some of the, I've you know, talked plenty about it these past several months, probably since its inception, maybe a little bit later, since I didn't quite realize that I wasn't such a fan of it. I've talked about it a lot on the podcast, but we're going to just kind of break down and have an actual discussion about it with a bit of my thoughts pre-composed. And so double elim, I'm going to just talk about things that I don't think that work with it, because again, I'm not a big fan. Steven, feel free to counter me with anything that that you think that contradicts what I'm mentioning.
Sure.
But double elim, basically, it punishes you for losing early on instead of later in the tournament. And, you know, maybe that's not such a bad thing. You know, we see that in Swiss, too, that you're going to have worse resistance if you lose early in the tournament, because generally you're playing against lower level opponents, or you're going to have a smaller sum of wins of when you add up your opponents, basically how resistance is calculated. You're a lot more likely to have a lower resistance if you lose early. And that can make it tough to squeeze into top cut if it's a you know, a solid cut. It's not X and 2 cut or something. That's a factor in both of them, but it's a lot more punishing in double elim because of the number of games you have to play. That actually changes depending on when you lose. And so there's this graphic that Players Cup has put out, basically breaking down what it how the tournament would flow. And so if you win 7 games, you can make it out in winners. However, you can lose the first round and have to go through all 12 rounds of losers to have a chance to make it to the finals. And that is 5 more games that you would have to win compared to the players that just won every game. And obviously, players that are winning should be rewarded, but rewarding them so much so just makes it so much more daunting when there's a lot of factors that are not totally in your control. The seeding in these tournaments is not exactly the best. I wouldn't say it's entirely random. We're realizing now that it seems to be based on your finish in the qualifier, the IC.
Yeah, the pre-qualifier, whatever. The online competition they have for it.
Yeah, your seeding seems to be based off of that. And the second time around in Players Cup 2, they did reward buys to the top finishing players, which was a strong strong change. That was something that I was happy to see. And so the buys were given out randomly in the first one, but the second one, the buys were distributed to the top finishing players in the IC. And so now players know that while there's a certain point that you can call it to say that you're safe and qualified, there are benefits to pushing yourself further. However, ICs are not exactly the best measurement of a player's skill, so it's like I don't think anybody would doubt in saying ICs reward different skills than the best of three we see in either Swiss or Double LM tournaments. Wouldn't you agree, Steven?
Right.
So, like, somebody that's a top finisher in an IC might not be somebody that frequently wins, best of three events. There are definitely players that do both. Paul Chua is a very strong player, both at the regional level and the online best of one level, you know?
Yeah, I guess there are also pretty strong exceptions when we, shift the lens and kind of take a look at Japan's circuit over these last few years. Like, it's crazy to think how many of those... Well, I guess not how many, but there have been like maybe two or three that won their, online competition to qualify for their nationals, then they won nationals, then they won worlds. So specifically speaking about Shomen Honami and Ryoto Tsubo. So, are those two world champions from Japan. So a lot of players from Japan also probably have these same things where they win nationals. They also won their qualifier, which is also just like an international challenge kind of thing.
Yeah, so it definitely still estimates your skill as a Pokemon player, and there are exceptions, like Steven had mentioned, these absolute beasts of players that just are insane at the game. So the point I want to make, though, is that with this like random-ish seeding, you can queue into stronger players a lot earlier in the tournament. One player that we're probably going to be, at least I am going to be referencing a lot, is Andrew Ding and his run in Players Cup 2, where Andrew, as we had mentioned on the show before, I believe went, it was either 10 or 11 and 1. I can't remember which one, because I'm seeing there's these 12 rounds of losers.
Yeah, maybe did he lose round one of, what's it called? The winner's bracket?
Yes, so Andrew played...
So it's probably 11 and 1 then.
Yeah, it was probably 11 and 1. Andrew Ding went, in the first round, played Kyle Livinghouse, another strong player, for those that are familiar. And Andrew Ding is, of course, a strong player of his own merit. And so they had to play against each other in the first round, and Kyle was the winner of this, sending Andrew to losers. Andrew ended up fighting all the way to the final round, the winning in, last round of losers, and was playing against Bingji. Bingji Wang, I believe is his last name?
Yep.
Yeah, Bingji Wang. So the two of these players, obviously, again, for players that are familiar, they build their teams together. So they're running the exact same team. And Andrew ends up losing the mirror match on a meteor beam miss, is what we've been told. There wasn't like a stream of the games or anything. It's just what Andrew had shared with like Twitter or something. And it's crazy to think that a run like that can end. And, just with no reward at all, no nothing, just, I guess the merit of having a very impressive but not good enough run, And then there's a player like my good friend Nick Navarre, Nails, who had a round one bye because of, a strong finish in the IC, and then won all of his games. So went 4-0 in the first weekend, 2-0 in the next weekend, basically 6-0, but 7-0 because of the bye. And that was enough to qualify. Whereas Andrew Ding went 11-1, had, basically 5 more wins than Nick. 4 more if you don't count the bye, but I think you can count the bye. And yeah. Did not make it. did not make it to the finals. And, you know, which run is more impressive? You know, I hate to say it because, again, Nick is my good friend, but, you know, Andrew Ding's run is far more impressive. Like, winning that many games against a large field of players that were able to qualify for this tournament is no easy feat. You can't lose any game. There's no, you know, cushion when you're down there in losers. And so it's just an incredible run that was cut short and is just tragic to hear.
I will give you that look, that was an incredible run, you know, going 11-1 in this tournament. I guess ultimately 11-2, right? At the end of the
day. I guess, yeah, I keep mentioning that part, or keep forgetting that part. I guess it was 11-2, right?
Anyway, like, yes, that is a very fair point. Impressive run. But, you know, that's just the structure of the tournament. And while it sucks that sometimes some people have to play, you know, pretty much double the amount of games than another person in winners, like, that's just how double elimination works. And we kind of have to live with that. So, it's still impressive whether you make it through winners or losers. And ultimately, at the end of the day, you want to see people who have either you every all these qualifiers give us two players who did not lose at all and two players who only lost once. Everyone else was eliminated. They lost twice, right?
Yes.
Another point I just want to bring up is that Andrew Ding for the Players Cup 2 qualifier, think about like who he played his first round and his final round. Like, he's playing against Kyle Livinghouse, another regional champion. Andrew's a good player himself. He is also winning a regional. And then he's playing Bingji at the end there, who is also, I don't think he won a regional, but he's been, like, second place many times. Like, at least three, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah,
go ahead.
I think you were kind of talking about, like, you have to beat the players of merit to be able to deserve to make it to the finals. And so that point does stand. It's just, it's tragic that he had so many other games to even get to this point, you know, to fight Bingji in the last round. And it might have felt a little bit more justified if Andrew was eliminated by Bingji in losers round 8 or 9 or something. I don't know how many more games. Again, double elim can't be reworked to fit this narrative that I'm proposing. And it kind of brings me to my next point, which is Swiss just better? You know, Swiss is what we do for the in-person tournaments that we were doing for a long time. Steven will tell you that, you know, Swiss was not always here. We didn't have it way back in the day. But Swiss has been around for a while. It is what we're used to, at least for players that have been playing at the live events in the past couple of years. And essentially, you're not eliminated from the tournament at any point in Swiss. You are just eliminated from contention at a certain point. And that depends on what the top cut is, and the top cut, structure. Like, is it going to be a hard number cut, like a power of 2, a top 8, a top 16? Or will they do a X and 2 cut, where, you know, everybody have a record of X and 2 or better? I think it's been X and 1 in certain circumstances, but very rarely. Typically, X and 2 or better make it into the cut, and then they have, like, weird play-in games where if you have, like, 24 players, then the bottom 8 or 12 or something players, whatever, play a top 32 game to get to a round number of top 16, and then it just functions like normal from there.
Yeah.
The reason that I'm... Go ahead, Steven.
Oh, I just wanted to go on a silly little tangent and be like, all you people who maybe complain a little bit about double elimination, you should all be very happy with it that you get a chance to play twice to save yourself in the tournament in this event. Because like you mentioned, I've been playing for a long time. Back in the day, our tournaments were single elimination. They weren't even best of three. They were just one game single elimination, and you lose, you're out. So don't act entitled. Be happy with what you got here.
Hold on, Steven. Those formats, did they even have team preview?
No. We did in 2011,
that's not even,
though.
That's not even the same game.
Okay. Anyway, I want to get back to the Swiss structure here. So, obviously, you know, with double elimination, you know, once you've lost two, you've been knocked out of the tournament, right? So, you're just done. Like, you don't even get to play anymore. With Swiss, it's different because at live events, we know you can play, if it's like a 7-round, 8-round, 9-round tournament, you know you can play all those rounds. But once you're past the point of, like you mentioned, contention, you know, what are we going to do with those players, especially in this kind of tournament when we're all at home playing online and these TOs have to kind of deal with these all these players all over the place? Like, it's a very different story when your in-person all gathered in this one location, in this one venue, you know that everyone is pretty much going to be right there. And you can call over a PA for anyone who might be late. And if they don't show up, you know, you just give them a loss or drop them. But with everyone at home and playing online, like, it's a very different story there. Like, I don't want to have to, as thinking from a TO's perspective, I don't want to have to deal with some players who may be like 0-3 or X-3 or whatever, and having to like keep looking for them if they're not showing up to a round. I think for the circumstances we're in right now, with everyone being at home, it's double elimination is just a necessary evil that we kind of need to deal with. Like, could we do Swiss? Absolutely. And we could have players who are certain, you know, cut off either top 16 or all X-2, make it for a top cut and then go down to top 4 from there. But because of the factors of where we all are physically right now, I just feel like double elimination works better for what we're trying to get out of this tournament. And that is 4 finalists without having to deal with all these other people.
So I think one thing I want to mention, just kind of bouncing back, the tournament for Players Cup 2 was run such that they went up to losers round 8, which of course starts after winners round 1. And so if you were to lose winners round 1 and win all of the rest of the games, which I guess, again, bringing back Andrew Ding, that is what Andrew Ding did. Andrew Ding played 9 rounds of Pokemon and went 8-1. That means for the TOs that they were essentially TOing for 9 rounds, which is not too unlike Swiss from what we've seen from, 9-round Swiss regionals and nationals and whatever. And so the TOs were still having to run the same number of rounds. However, I will not detract from your point, Steven, that when players get hard eliminated, they no longer have to worry about these games. It drastically cuts down the number of games that the TOs are having to run, and is obviously going to make things a lot simpler for them, creating less issues, because obviously there's just less players to worry about in this online setting where they only have so much control over what they the information they can, you know, glean from these matches that have issues. So I almost wonder if we could run some kind of hybrid system, which is just like Swiss, but you are eliminated if you're out. It would obviously depend on the format of the cut. I think if it was like a hard X-2 cut, obviously the players are cut when they can no longer, when they're, you know, at 3 losses. And then if it's a top 16 or a top 8 cut, a hard number cut, then you probably just do the same system, eliminate players when they have 3 losses, unless 3 losses can somehow sneak in. I don't think that's ever a possibility. I don't think you eliminate players that are mathematically out, just because I don't know if the computers can calculate that or not. It depends on who you face, you know? So I think that system works for either form of top cut, whether the top cut is a hard number cut or if it's an X-2 record cut. I think maybe we could do some kind of hybrid system where X-3 players are just dropped from the tournament.
I think that could definitely work. I honestly, I would love to see these online events move to kind of a Swiss structure and see what we can do with that. Maybe like your proposed hybrid system. But I just think, I think more importantly, just from the TO's perspectives, is that logistically it's very difficult for them to manage this many number of players. Like each round as you go through, each loser round as you go through, like the number of players is drastically being reduced each round. So it makes it easier and easier to manage with the players who keep advancing farther. From their end, it just seems like it might be really complicated. I don't know.
Yeah, ultimately, I am not a TO, and so I don't know exactly how much less of a strain this puts on them. However, just as a player, I'm going to speak selfishly and just say the things that I'm interested in. So, obviously, keeping TOs in mind, though, is important. So,
can I bring up another point before we move on to team sheets?
Yeah, let's do it. What else do you want to mention?
So, we all know that Chris Brown from not the rapper, but Chris Brown, the Play Pokemon head organizer, AlphaZella, his username is. You can find him all over the place. Smashboards. What's the Splatoon one called? Splatboards?
I don't actually know. That's fun.
Yeah, Splatoon also has like a spinoff of Smash Bros, which is Splatboards. And he's also on Twitter, but his roots are from the fighting game community. And as we all know, in the fighting game community, whether it's Super Smash Bros. Or Street Fighter, anything in that department, they very much run double elimination tournaments all throughout. They sometimes run pools before that too. But it is something that he, as the head, is very familiar with. And as the head, probably proposed this to be the structure for the tournament. So with Chris at the helm, I feel like this is just, you know, what he is strongly familiar with and wants to keep with for both Pokken, or I guess for all of them, Pokken, TCG, and for us, VGC.
Yeah, and so bringing Smash into the conversation, I did kind of like skip over this point earlier. I mentioned that it's tough if you queue into a strong player early in the tournament. It can also be very tough if you queue into a tough matchup. Pokemon is a pretty matchup-heavy game, and it's tough to make a team that covers every aspect of the format. And so a little bit of every tournament is hoping that you don't face this one archetype that completely destroys yours, or maybe it's not so bad, but maybe it gives you a harder time. And if you're playing against a tough matchup from a strong player, it can make it even harder to overcome. And that's just kind of the nature of Pokemon, especially with more and more Pokemon being added, more and more moves, mechanics, and to the point that maybe it's just hard to cover everything. And so maybe you get unlucky and fight a Colossal team, which at this point you shouldn't be sleeping on Colossal, but we're using Colossal as an example. If you fight a Colossal team early in the tournament and suffer a loss, you're going to have to play so many more games. If you had played Colossal in Winner's Round 7 and lost there, you would only have to play one more game just to try to make it into the finals. And it's just kind of tragic that that is like the nature of the tournament. And it's not like this is, you mentioned Chris Brown and how Chris runs these double elimination. Like that's how like the double elim works for like Smash and other fighting games. But in those games, I think it's a bit easier to overcome a bad matchup just from your strength as a player. Like obviously I'm not that experienced with fighting games, but it just does seem like a strong player is going to be able to beat a character that they're bad against if they have a significant skill gap over the player that they're facing.
Yeah, I'll give you the point that sometimes in Pokemon, your team may just have a bad matchup against another like team archetype or another team like that. But wouldn't you also say it's part of the player's responsibility to be able to, you know, patch that bad matchup as much as possible and also just have game plans and what is how you can approach it?
Yes and no. Like I had said, the more Pokemon we add to the game, the more complex it gets, the harder it gets to cover all of the strategies, in my opinion. There are so many, just to list off like a bunch of random like archetypes. There's Sand, Colossal, Sun, there's like Hard Trick Room, there's just like a bunch of random things. I haven't actually been too up to date with the metagame currently. But, you know, picking, sometimes you have to pick and choose. Sometimes you have to say, I'm fine with this matchup being 60-40 in the favor of my opponent just because I am 60-40 against, you know, maybe 75% of teams, maybe 80 or something, you know, and you find a team that is going to be good against most things. But, you know, there's this team that shows up, maybe 10% of the time, maybe less, maybe more. And you have to just like pick and choose your matchups sometimes. It really depends on the format. And there are probably better players that are going to tell me, no, you're wrong. You can just build a team that covers all these things. But I don't think that's too reasonable, in my opinion. And so it just sucks to be punished for running into a matchup that, again, you have no control over. There's no seeding for the tournament. There's no way to anticipate what you're going to be fighting. And so it's, it's just tough. I don't know. That's just my thoughts, is that it in a matchup heavy game, it sucks to lose to a tough matchup early and get punished so severely.
Okay. And, you and a bunch of other people have more experience in these double elimination tournaments and Players Cups because you've actually played in them. I have not qualified for one yet. Maybe we'll see if I can get this done this month, but who knows, man. One last thing before we move on to the open team sheets, discussing those, is for this double elimination structure, we already have it solidified for Players' Cup 3. But in the likely case we get Players' Cup 4, I think, are you a yay or nay for double elimination for the structure, or do you want to see something different?
I'm a nay for Players' Cup 3, and this is where I'll just like get a little bit like not like too personal, and it's probably just as a VGC as a whole. As I had mentioned earlier, I was speaking a little bit from my own experience when I said, here's a reminder to sign up for the IC, sign up just so you have the option to play, even if you don't want to. And I have not yet signed up for the IC, and I'm going to. But I am very much in that sign up just in case stage. I don't think I'm going to play, is where I'm at right now. I am just not enjoying VGC very much at the time, at this time. I think that online tournaments have felt just entirely different than the live events that I miss. And it just, I don't know, it doesn't give me the same excitement. And I've been enjoying other facets of life. So I don't know if I'm going to play in this. And I think a little bit of it is the double elim aspect of it. Like, you know, playing in this tournament that takes place over the course of 3 months, ultimately to, I don't know, like I had mentioned before in the podcast, you know, you don't get anything until you reach top four of the global finals. And
yeah, that prizing.
You have to put in so much work to reach that point. It's just so daunting, you know, when you're sitting at the beginning and you're like, do I really want to commit the next 3 months to this tournament that is, being realistic, going to be, really hard to make top four in? And, you know, you got everybody all over the world entering this. And so, I might just sit this one out.
Fair enough. Okay. I see your points there. Obviously, like, it's not a fault on you of not wanting to play anymore. It's really just, like, the circumstances that led to the where we are in the world right now. Like, we can't, there's nothing else we can really do. So, as for me, like, for my opinion on this is, like, I'm just a yay for double elimination for Players' Cup 4 if we get that. So, I think that's a necessary evil and we're going to stick with it. So, I think we've said our pieces on double elimination. Let's move on to open team sheets here, and then I'll ask you the same question at the end of that if you want to see that in the future.
Yeah. So let's start talking about open team sheets. The first point actually kind of talks about its relation to double elim. So this is like our interesting little transition. But then after that, we're going to kind of sway away from the Players' Cup 2 or just Players' Cup structure and just talk more about open team sheets. And so my first point here is that team sheets makes prep time so much more powerful. It's a lot, the matches become a lot more structured, a lot more played out. It's like a cheesy example. It's like a practice, what is it? Like a dance? I don't know what I'm trying to say. You know, like it's a
rehearsal?
Rehearsal, you know, something like that. Like, I don't know what the word is. But what I'm trying to say is that, you know, the players have figured out what they're going to be doing so much so beforehand that...
Wait, are you simulating? Is it simulation? Are you simulating the match or something?
I really don't know what I was going for. Honestly, okay. I'm lost in my own example. I'm lost in my own metaphor. So the point I'm trying to make is that the matches are played out so much beforehand that... all your moves when you hit the match stage feel very pre-calculated, you know? And we see these matches played out with little improvisation. And it might be tough to tell that from a spectator's perspective. But it just means that ultimately, in a lot of cases, one player is going to learn that they have something that is going to be almost insurmountable for the other player to stop. Especially when they know all of their options, that it's going to be very tough for them to overcome it. There are some games that still end up being interesting. Like it ultimately, I find, and this is going to be just like a dramatic opinion and probably wrong. It seems like games are either very one-sided or very coin flippy. You know, it's like, okay, I realized that they can't cover me leading Dragapult Colossal, or switching it up and leading Regigigas Weezing. You know, like there was a team that had both of those modes on the same team. And so then my opponent has to guess which of those two I'm leading. And if they lead countering this, then they're going to win. And if they don't, I am going to win. Other matchups, you find that, wow, they have nothing for Dragapult Colossal. And you know that because you got to see their full team and you got to run a bunch of practice games against your friend during the week beforehand, or maybe the hour beforehand, depending on what point of the tournament you're at. And you just learn that, and then you just steamroll. No pun intended. But, yeah, like, I don't enjoy those aspects of the game. I like it more when there's this improvisation where it's, you know, you're on a timer to find the best move. And you'll see some blunders. You'll see some players, you know, make misplays. You'll see some players find the strongest option, and you know that they did that on a limited time frame, and so you say, wow, this player covered everything, that's so amazing, when it's a lot less impressive when, oh, they had a week to figure out this move that is going to cover everything.
Yeah, it's just really funny how, like, we lost Hidden Power this generation, and now we have open team sheets anyway, so nothing's hidden anyway from your opponents for these online events. It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, the prep time, you know, we've seen this at some regionals in the past at live events where overnight between the Swiss and Top Cut rounds, you see a lot of these first rounds kind of be like blowouts or dominating performances. And from there, you kind of get more of those improvisational matches that we see, just moving forward throughout those tournaments. But, I totally see the point here. Just like your prep time can be just very methodical and makes it more important for these tournaments because you have all the tools to be able to do that a lot more easily. Likewise, like, your friend networks also, I guess this is kind of both a positive and a negative here. Like, they become more powerful, also they're more level off the playing field.
Yes. So, one last thing I'm going to bounce back, though, Steven, just talking about the prep time, just so we can wrap up Double O Limb and move on, is that a specific example in, like, Players Cup 2 is if you're in, the winner's side and you lose, getting knocked down to losers, maybe you made it to winner's round 5 and get lost, you might have a decent amount of time to see who you're going to be playing against in the loser's side, because the loser's bracket is usually a bit behind. And so when you do actually lose out of winners, you're going to be waiting for a little bit to see who you face. And this means that you get a decent advantage on the players that are in losers. And, this is why losing later is just so much stronger in Double LM. And it means that you have more time to figure out what you're going to be playing against, and then you get these your opponent as a player coming from losers is much more prepared for you. So
wait, random question.
Mm-hmm.
When you are playing in the events and are not like in a battle, but you know, kind of just had downtime and were waiting for your next opponent, were you able to see like the live updates to the tournament as they happen, like who was winning and advancing and people got knocked out and all that stuff?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
And like cool. So you could see that, you could get an idea of like who is, you could see the whole bracket, and as it like updates, maybe you had to refresh it, but yeah, like you would see the bracket as it goes and like, all the updates and whatever. You also would, you still have all the team sheets, of course. That was something that was different in Players Cup 2. And, I think will probably be this case for Players Cup 3, is that all team sheets were accessible at all times, which really made this, an issue of Double O Limb and not just an issue of friend networks. You just had access to the, like you say, oh, I'm playing against either Steven or Alex next round, so let's go open up both of their teams, figure out at least what I want to lead against both of them, and then start thinking more from there and come up with a game plan. Whereas Steven and Alex are focused on their matches that they're playing now. Actually, I guess it's Steven versus Alex in this case. So Steven and Alex are much more focused on beating each other. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately one of them wins and the pairings go up and they're just like, yeah, here's your next opponent. Whenever you're ready, go ahead and start. And it just gives you a lot less time, even if you do take a little bit of a break, because I think most people will allow you to take a break if the round hasn't started. You can take 10 minutes to, you know, go to the bathroom and maybe prepare your matchup a little bit. You won't have as much time, ultimately that's just 10 more minutes your opponent gets as well. And you're going to be behind on game planning.
Cool. For the listeners out there, you know, I'm just curious. Like, I didn't get to play in these things, so I don't know what's going on in the tournaments. So please bear with me. Now, let's just talk about friends. It's always nice to have friends.
Little bit too nice to have friends, ain't it? It is one of the daunting things of Pokemon being such a information-heavy game that friend networks are terribly powerful. It is something that you'll come to realize as you start playing the game that, this person knows my team already. Maybe you find out from them telling you, or maybe you just get destroyed and wonder how they knew what your strategy was. And it's because of friend networks. You know, having a group of friends means that there's going to be people looking out for you, people who want you to win. And so they're going to help you over the random person or person that they're not friends with. So they're going to share information. And this means in the concepts of open team sheets, you have friends that you can run games against. You know, if you don't have a lot of strong players that you are friends with, then you're not going to get as much benefit from having the open team sheet. Whereas, like, if you have a network of strong players, you can say, hey, play some games against me with this team that my opponent is using for next week. And let's see how you play it and how I am going to win this. And then you give it to another friend. They're going to figure out how they play it. Or, you know, your friends, maybe you flip the roles. I've been in this situation. So, like, you know, I'll play my opponent's team and I'll have my friend play my team and just be like, all right, I'm going to try to use my opponent's team to destroy you as much as I can just to get a feel for what their team is. And, you know, not everybody's going to have access to that if they don't have a large friend group or if they don't have, you know, a strong set of friends, you know. So it's something that makes friend networks a little bit more powerful. There are aspects, though, that we'll cover a little bit in a moment that make it friend groups a little bit weaker.
Yeah, it's important. You can also see if your friends who played a previous opponent know what they brought to the game, you know, what four they brought, what they actually led with those among their team. And like you mentioned, you know, while friend networks can be very strong, this open team sheet rule for these Player's Cup tournaments have really leveled off the playing field in many ways. Like, just because you have friends doesn't mean you have doesn't mean that other people don't have information. This levels it off for everybody. Everybody can see, well, I guess nowadays with everybody else's team. So it also just helps as a cheating measure as well for these online tournaments where we can't lock our battle boxes. But this also just helps for, you know, players who are breaking into the scene. I've seen a lot of posts with people who were saying, like, hey, I started playing VGC, playing Pokemon in 2020 in the like online only era so far. And this is like really all they're accustomed to. So it's nice for them for these events that, you know, especially if you're brand new, like you may not necessarily know people at the beginning.
Man, to think of the people that have to go in the reverse if we do return to closed team sheets, just like...
Oh, that's, man, right.
It's so weird, you know, people that enter the game later than you because they didn't get to have all of your experiences, so...
I will say this, though. Like, wherever you practice, whether it's Showdown or Battle Stadium, like, that's all, like, closed information. Like, you still have to play as if it's a closed team sheet game. So you're still getting that practice in that mode, I guess.
That's fair. Like, yeah, when you practice or test a team, you are playing in a closed information setting. So, good point to mention there. Let's see. So, I guess let's jump to the next point here. That again, these two points are just side notes that I had noticed while doing a bit of my research. But you know, maybe open team sheets is a thing that is nice to have. When you're playing a Dynamax format, you know, it's nice to know which Pokemon is holding the weakness policy. It's nice to know if they have some cheesy weakness policy activating move that most Pokemon wouldn't run, and the other cheese options that might be available. It's nice specifically with regards to Dynamax, at least maybe. I don't know.
It's a good example is actually that Raichu with that Glare and Moltres team we talked about earlier in the show. Is it having Draining Kiss, right? Like, if you didn't have the open team sheet, like, obviously, they can still use an electric move to proc the Moltres as a weakness policy. But maybe, like, the end game is a Raichu versus a Garchomp, and the Garchomp is really weak, and you may think, I have this in the bag. They have no way to hit me with their electric moves. And then Draining Kiss shows up, and it's like, oh, no. I just lost. But, totally.
Yeah, and so that actually kind of brings to the next point. You know, preserving information for cut no longer exists in this setting, and I think that's both good and a bad thing. It means that you no longer get to have these cool tech moves like Draining Kiss on your Raichu that'll totally catch your opponent off guard. And I'm talking about stuff that is still strong in a best of three setting. You know, I'm not talking about like the best of one cheese where you like, you know, oh, I skill swapped like pure power onto, or huge power onto my Slaking, and haha, you didn't know that I had this like crazy long setup thing that definitely won't work in game two. I'm talking about, you know, those little techs like the Draining Kiss on the Raichu that can steal you a game, but also still has functionality outside of that. They no longer steal you those games because your opponent is just aware of them from the start. And then, I like I had mentioned at the top, you know, there's no more preserving information for cut. So in every game, you have every option available to you. This is a concept that might be a little bit strange to the players that, you know, have only played in this era. But if with these friend networks that I have talked about being very strong, it is smart sometimes to say, oh, I could win this game by clicking Draining Kiss with my Raichu. But I could also win this game by, you know, taking four more turns to slowly knock out this Garchomp instead of ending the game right now. And this means that going into cut, nobody knows that you have Draining Kiss on your Raichu. Or like at least nobody that's friends with this person. So that aspect of the game is gone with Open Team Sheet. And it's a small facet, but it's just something I wanted to mention.
Yeah, I actually like those a lot, like being able to hold on to some of these secrets on your team. Even still with open team sheets, I'll say like the way a person plays their team can be drastically different from another way another person plays that exact same team. Also, just like any archetype, you know, players can play them very differently. So they're still, you still have to adjust to each specific player in a tournament.
Yes, yes. And now let's go ahead and talk about Steven and I have talked about in the past, but what this might mean for live events. You know, is this something that we think could be feasible at live events? Do we think that this is a good thing or bad thing for live events? And
you know what a great thing to learn would be is like Taiwan, whatever happened there, like someone who was there or knows about it, please tell us more. Like, was that closed or open team sheets there? We gotta know.
That's true. I actually don't know the answer to that, and that would be very interesting. Yeah, like, we've been doing open team sheet everything for these past couple of months, and a lot of the grassroots have been adopting it, too. Some have not, but for the most part, it's pretty popular right now because people want to practice what the official circuit is doing.
Understandably.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, you know, if you want to do well in Players' Cup, maybe you're going to play in some grassroots that are of a similar format. So, tournament format, that is. And, yeah, I think that for live events, Steven and I talked about the, like, logistics of this in a past episode. I don't know exactly which one, but, we basically have covered this before, but, I wanted to mention the idea of having, you know, closed team sheets for Swiss, but open for Top Cut. And this would kind of, nerf the, preparing games for like basically friend networks. Basically, it would nerf the aspect where your friends go home, or you know, the Top Cut players go home, and those with a lot of friends ask around and say, hey, I'm playing against Joe and they have like, you know, these six Pokemon, do you know anybody that played them, do you know that has any more information? And then they get a lot of information on the team so that when they start practicing against it and running those test games, they can run more accurate games. And instead, this just opens it all up so that the player that made cut and doesn't know anybody, anything about their opponent, doesn't know even the six Pokemon, they don't have to improvise nearly as much when they get to the game. And it's like a facet of the game that is like unavoidable. Like, people are going to share information, people are going to have friends. So at that point, why not just open it up and give everyone the info for cut, but keep it closed during Swiss so we still have that like aspect of the game where you you know, can use tech moves, can use fun options that are less common and actually get the most out of them.
Yeah, like I mentioned, we talked about that whole concept in the past about whether it's viable for live events. Again, like speaking on that, like a 350-person event, trying to get open team sheets to everybody, whether it's on in paper or on your phone, not really viable. But when you whittle it down to maybe like 16 or 8 players left, like that's doable, I think. And we've seen things like this done in the past. We've mentioned this several times already, but the Japan Nationals have done this. I know at least 2016 for sure, perhaps others as well. But they had pools to qualify. I think it was like their top player from each pool. They had 8 pools of 4, and then the first place of each pool moved on to top cut. And the top cut was all open information. Like they had their item, moves, and the Pokemon all there on like this big like display screen from what I remember watching that stream many years ago.
I remember when we were looking at this, we were like appalled, or not like appalled, but like just baffled, I guess is the word I want to use. You know, we were like, wow, those teams are just pasted on the wall. Everyone knows what they're doing.
Yeah, they're crazy. What are they doing?
Yeah, it's just like you've removed all semblance of secrecy. What? This is crazy. So, yeah, I just remember that being a thing. And, like, yeah, it's been done before, and we're kind of trending in that direction. That might be a possibility for us if this is the route we want to go.
Yeah, it's funny how normalized it is in these last 8 months, I suppose, and I guess moving forward a little bit here. But I kind of want to talk about, like, how it feels different playing with these open information versus closed. Like we've both played, or I guess not really, not me, but we played in times when you just played without your opponent's team information straight and open to you. But this changes the way the game plays a little bit for you.
Yeah, and so I'm actually going to reference a lot of points that were brought up in a tweet from Nails, Nick Navarre, as we had mentioned a couple times throughout this episode, that you can find on his Twitter. Like, again, it sucks that I think we talked about this 2 episodes ago, Steven, or maybe 1, where we talked about we have no online medium for these discussions or forums, or maybe we talked about that off the podcast. But, man, Twitter is a terrible hub for VGC, because finding old conversations is a slog. Anyway. There was this old discussion, do you prefer open or closed team sheets? And Nick went on to make a couple of points. One, talking about how open team sheets incentivize aggressive play, because you know exactly what your opponent's counterplay options are. For example, because I'd like to pick easy examples, if you're using Dragapult Colossal, you know exactly what their counterplay is to that. Do they have a ground move somewhere? Do they have a water move somewhere? Do they have some way to take out the Dragapult before it can act, you know? And if they don't, then you know that it's time to steamroll. That was a pun on purpose. Now, closed team sheets, they allow you to play a bit more, or they don't allow you to, they promote more conservative play, because it would be risky to say, you know, set up your Dragapult, or not your Dragapult, your Colossal in front of like a Goodra, when you don't know if that Goodra has a water move or not. You know, maybe the Goodra doesn't have a water move, but you have to respect the option. And so you go with another route of your team and don't go with the Colossal mode. And so I like that aspect of it, because it can change how the game, you know, maybe you fish for that information in game one. You know, and if you don't get punished for it, you continue to go with Colossal. And if you do get punished for it, you decide, all right, I sacrificed my whole game one. Was it worth it? Was it not? And you can figure out what's your best game plan going forward.
I guess that's kind of the argument for open team sheets, though, is like, in this case, I don't have to sacrifice, you know, trying to gather information when I already have it. So that's one of the arguments as, I guess, a pro for having open
team sheets. I would say it's for and against, is because that aspect, then you could also choose to just forego it entirely. You forego it entirely, and like that's like the risk-reward assessment that is on the player. Do I want to fish and find out that the Goodra has a water move, or do I just go with that game, that, you know, that plan B, and say I'm using my Urshifu to, I don't know, soften up this Goodra, or, you know, I expect them to go with the Goodra mode or whatever, and I don't think my Colossal is going to be able to power through, so let's do something else. And, you know, it allows the players to make those assessments without perfect information, and You know, it's I think it's just a bit more interesting for myself as a player and as a spectator.
Yeah, I still want to just bring it back to that poker analogy. Like, when you know your opponent's hand, and if they're bluffing or something, like, you know, okay, I'm just going to fold here. I'm not going to bet. Like, you have, or if they're bluffing, like, I'm going to keep betting. Like, you can't beat me in this hand. And just, like, just the analogy to Pokemon is just like, well, I know you have this move. I know I can't use this strategy, and I can't use this Pokemon, or I can't make this move on this turn right now. So it's the rule of the tournament, and it just feels like such a different game.
Yeah, I like that aspect, mentioning like bluffing, because like that's something that you can't do in an open team sheet format is, you know, well, I'm gonna lead Gujra because they're gonna respect it, you know, they're gonna worry about it. Like that I led it because I had a reason, and maybe the reason is I'm lying. I am completely lying about there being a threat. But you're worried about it, aren't you? And that's just fun. I like that aspect of Pokemon. So yeah, the open team sheets just they lead to a lot of like flow charting, that's like a different skill set, and like I don't want to completely detract from that. Like being able to analyze your opponent's team and learn what is the best course of action for your team going forward is something that you have to do. It's not like the game does it for you. There's no you know, move calculators that you can plug your teams in to, and it's just going to tell you how to play. You still have to figure it out on your own, but it's just having that time and all the information you need to do so is, I don't know, a lot less interesting to me than the improvisationalization. I don't even know the word. The improvisational aspect of Pokemon.
Got it. Trying to improv. You know, I really miss having those bluffing aspects. Because, like, just an example I want to bring up is back in 2015 format, I was just using, like, a good stuff Charizard Y team. My Charizard Y had Hidden Power Ground for Heatran, of course. And I remember in one of these, like, tournaments I played in that I could have just Hidden Power Grounded this Heatran and probably won that turn at the end of that game. But I decided, because it was game one of a best of three, I decided to just play out like four or five more turns. Like I knew I was in for four or five more turns if I played it this way, to not reveal Hidden Power Ground. And that way in game two, I was able to use it then to catch my opponent off guard. And it worked. Like game one, I played it out longer, ended up winning. And then game two, I just pulled it out right away. And then that knockout won me the game right away. So I missed that a lot.
Yeah, that aspect is super fun. That, you know, again, that brings us back to that conserving info, but on a smaller scale, you know, just like conserving info for the set for just that game. It's really a cool thing that you can do. It's I guess the word there is almost like conditioning your opponent to think that their Heatran is safe in front of this Charizard, but it turns out you actually have a tech that you've been waiting to pull off, and when you really, your opponent has no other reason to suspect it.
I'll tell you, I got to pull it off on some people, but it's also been done to me, so I feel it. Thanks, TolarWeb.
Yeah, like I think that's a I think that's a fun part of the game that I really do miss. And I don't want to be, I think I want to cap this off, since we're kind of wrapping up here. I want to cap this off that I am not proposing that, like, I want to be this, like, special best of one surprise player that's like, haha, you didn't see my, pure power slacking coming, or like, you know, I've got these, cheesy, like, you know, I don't even know what other, like, weird moves, you know, maybe I'm running a fighting move on Rillaboom that's like not so common, and you're just like, I'm just like, yep, you got, you know, yeah, how could you have seen that coming, huh? And I got a cheesy little win because of it. And I'm more proposing that it's fun when you get to see stuff like this Hidden Power Ground that Steven mentioned, the Draining Kiss on the Raichu, these moves that are created for fringe situations, but when the fringe situation comes, you want to be able to take advantage of it. You want to be able to actually make it happen instead of your opponent saying, well, I'm never going to fall for that trap.
Right, exactly. So, obviously, with the open team sheets, like, everyone can pretty much make their optimal play each turn. I know that was an assessment made back in the summer when we first had this rule. Like, it's been really nice to just play optimally every turn because I know all the options available to my opponent. So that's been a nice facet of this new rule, the open team sheet. But, you know, I really do just miss And it's funny, just me saying miss, because you still get this experience on Showdown. You still get this experience practicing anywhere, Battle Stadium as well, like of, you know, assessing the team composition, assessing the way an opponent has been playing. Do they have this move? Do they have this item? Like, can I safely play? Is this my best play on this turn, given the information I've learned? So, look, once the pandemic is over, we'll see what becomes of this rule. Again, people, reach out to us about the Taiwan Regional. If you know anything about it, we got to know more. But we'll just see what happens with this. Like, it's a different way to play with the open team sheet rule. And Alex, we can have some final closing thoughts on this. But again, I just want to ask this question about the open team sheets rule. For, I guess, the next, I don't know, I guess for the next Players' Cup and then the next live events, let's make this two questions. Yay or nay?
So for Players' Cup, this is where, though I disagreed with you on like the necessity of double elim, open team sheets is probably a necessity for these online events, especially the Players' Cup, because okay. They just don't have any way to lock the battle boxes. If we had the ability to lock battle boxes, I would be ready to throw this to the wind. But I think that... because we need to be able to prevent cheating, basically just that. I think it's probably a necessary evil. I'm okay enough with it. There are benefits to open team sheets that hopefully we've covered throughout this. It is also, I guess, like fun that you don't have to like worry about some kind of crazy surprise option from your team, but ultimately, or from your opponent's team. Ultimately, I am against open team sheets, but I do see some of the benefits of it. And the last thing I do want to say here, and Steven and I probably should have done this before we did the episode, but if you guys have any thoughts about double elim and team sheets that you didn't see us bring up, or if you, or I guess here, spring up, and didn't, it wasn't covered, or you completely disagree with us because of some reason and you want us to kind of address it, please like send us some feedback. We would love to kind of talk a bit more about this if you guys have anything else that you feel was not covered properly. Other than that, going forward, there's no way that this doesn't get mentioned again, even if in like passing, because I just can't shut up about like, you know, double elim and team sheets. so like no promises. This is just like getting our thoughts into a well-composed discussion. Where in the future episodes, I'm still going to say, like, man, this wouldn't be a thing if double elim wasn't possible. It's still going to come up, certainly, because it's still the format for Players' Cup 3. So,
Right. And you brought up most of the points already, so I'm just going to give my answers. Like, for Players' Cup online events, I'm going to say yay for the open team sheets. For live events in the future, whenever we get back to those, Taiwan, you're doing a good job. Very proud of you. So... I'm a nay for those, for open team sheets, for live events, but what was your answer for live events?
Isn't it kind of obvious from this whole thing, Steven? I think it's a necessary evil. It's a necessary evil for Players Cup, but if it is an evil,
yes,
I prefer...
that's obvious enough. But obviously, like you mentioned, if anyone wants to reach out to us about information about that Taiwan Regional or about what we talked about here, we'd be happy to talk more about this next week, next time. So, you know, Alex, that puts a nice little ribbon on the conversation here. I think we're pretty much wrapped up here.
Yeah, so this is the part where I guess we had just mentioned a bunch of, like, a bunch of things that we would love to hear from you guys about, and I'll let you do your thing, Steven. But yeah, just, like, email us or, you know, reach out to us at all these other places that I'm going to let Steven do, because I stole that from him, like, a couple of weeks ago, and I'm not going to do it again. At least not so soon.
Oh, no.
Not so soon.
It was fine. That email was vgchypervoice@gmail.com. Send us those comments, questions, and feedback for us. Tell your friends about this show. If they're interested in a show about competitive Pokemon, they can find us here at the Hypervoice. You can also find the show on a variety of different podcasting platforms. We are all over the place. When our most, probably the more highlight spots are Apple or iTunes, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Remember to leave us a review, say, for example, on Apple Podcasts, to help us with the visibility so that others can discover the show and find us here. You can also find the show on Facebook and on Twitter at The Hypervoice. Lastly, you can follow the two of us personally on Twitter as well. You can follow me at Super Morioka. And Alex, where can people follow you?
You can follow me at LexiconVGC.
Awesome. Well, happy 2021 to everybody.
Let's hope it's better this time.
Hope so. We'll see. Thank you, the listener, so much for listening to our show. We appreciate it. And stay tuned for more of the Hyperforce.
Stay safe out there, peeps. Alola.